Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks again for joining me this week. We've got a great guest for you. You're going to love him. He's the chief of police in Fresno. You'll hear him in the interview room. But before we get into that, make sure that you check me out on Facebook under Randy Sutton Public Figure. And if you're a Twitterer, at LT Randy Sutton. We've got a lot of interesting things to talk about. The insanity taking place all over this country involving all things law enforcement. And we're going to talk about that in my view from the blue as we go into the briefing room.
The briefing room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
Now, I've already given up completely on the NFL. After the antics with this Colin Kaepernick and all his buddies doing the kneeling and disrespecting not just our military, but of course our law enforcement with their false narrative about, you know, law enforcement out there, attacking poor young black men for no reason and shooting and killing people because we enjoy it, that kind of thing. So I gave up on the NFL. Now, if I didn't need another reason for it, I would have to say that the insanity generated by the Super Bowl was just outrageous. What is it about people that they just look for any excuse to act like morons? Well, Philadelphia Eagles, of course, won the game. Now, I had a discussion with several cops that morning, and somebody said, you know what's going to happen if the Eagles lose? And another guy said, yeah, sure, they're going to riot. They're going to burn the place down. And then I said, well, what's going to happen if they win? And everybody laughed. They said, they're going to riot and burn the place down. That's exactly what happened. What is it about putting thousands of people into a confined area and they got to act like idiots, overturning cars and burning stores? And, you know, is it the end of civilization? Because watching this just makes me sick. You know, in fact, while we're on this subject, I did a news interview today, referenced something that happened on the Las Vegas Strip. And I got to tell you, man, my blood pressure went off the charts. There's a viral video that's out there, and it occurred on the Strip just a couple nights ago, where this woman is unconscious, basically unconscious. She's on the street in, it looks like, the Las Vegas Strip. I mean, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of people walking by her. Now, she's basically unconscious. There's a bottle of booze there. Whether she was drunk, whether she was high, whether she had a seizure, I don't know. But she was laying there on the sidewalk. And this punk comes up to her and for five minutes molests her in full view of everybody. And you know how many people stood up to help her? How about zero? Zero. This guy is all over her, and it's disgusting to watch. And what are people doing? They're taking pictures of it with their cameras. I was watching this incredulously. A couple women stopped and said something to her, but she was unconscious. And then they just got up and walked away. I don't even know if anybody even called 911. But for 5 minutes, this punk, and then he looks up and he grins, and some people encourage him. I mean, it was like the Lord of the Flies, for God's sake. What is going on with our society? I told, and I know they're going to cut this out of the interview, but I told the reporter, I said, if that had been me walking by that guy, I would have used physical force. Let me put it that way. I would have torn this guy off of her, and he'd have been sorry that he ever laid eyes on her. It was that bad. So between Philadelphia and watching thousands of people become complete morons and loot and riot and burn and all because they're happy. And then seeing this occur on the Las Vegas Strip, I got to tell you, I have serious questions about humanity. And it made me wish I was a cop again and walking in that area when that happened. I can tell you that. So while we're on the subject of law enforcement and the insanity that's going on, there, I could talk for an hour today about some of the things that are taking place. There was a little bit of good news, but it was based on something that never should have happened. And that is a police officer in Long Island, New York, was just found not guilty of assaulting two people. Let me tell you this case, though, because it's outrageous. Now, I remember reading about this and then blogging about it on Facebook, and also I think I talked about it on the show as well. This police officer, his name is Federico, works for a very Tony area in Long Island, very rich, very wealthy area. And he gets a disturbance call. There's a fight taking place outside of a bar. Turns out there are these two brothers, the Kavanaugh brothers, Brendan and Kevin, and they're fighting. They're beating each other's butts, right? So he goes over to break it up, and they attack him. And I mean, they attack him. He's in a fight for his life. And he gets his taser out, deploys his taser, doesn't do any good. He winds up hitting one of them in the head with the taser, you know, gave a little scratch. And eventually, backup got there. They took him into custody. They were arrested for assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest and such. Well, it turns out his father's a multi-millionaire and has got all the right influence in all the right places. So this poor officer goes to work one day and they arrest him. This district attorney, through the influence of the Kavanaugh, the rich guy, indicts this police officer for using his taser against these guys in an improper way. Now, so he charges them with a felony assault. It's unbelievable that and the union, of course, and the police department, as soon as they arrest him, well, he's fired. I mean, his career is over. Well, we're now about a year and a half later, maybe 2 years later. He went to trial, and he won. And he was found not guilty of everything, which, of course, is as it should be. And now, you know what? The department's going to have to reinstate him. And but this is corruption. The district attorney in Long Island indicted this police officer for doing his job and defending himself. It's absolutely outrageous. What they have done to this young man, I mean, I don't know if he'd ever want to go back and work for this police department again or ever want to be a cop again. And all I can say is I hope he sues the hell out of them. I hope he sues the Kavanaughs. I hope he sues the district attorney, because this guy needs to be disbarred. And anybody part of this prosecution, it's not tough enough to be a cop now. Now we have to start arresting them for defending themselves. It's unconscionable, but at least there was justice at the end of this journey for this poor officer, that he was found not guilty, and he's going to be back, you know, if he wants to go back to work, he's going to be allowed to be. I don't know if you've been following everything that's been going on in Baltimore, but it seems like one thing after another in that city. The leadership of that city is out of control. So first we had, you'll remember the riots, where the mayor gave permission, basically, for the rioters to go out and do their thing. and we had the police commissioner over there not allow their cops to wear protective gear, thereby getting scores of them injured. So we then see the mayor got ousted, the police commissioner got ousted, and you would think that maybe people with common sense would get into office, but no. Then we have the Freddie Gray debacle, where Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, comes out, falsely arrests six cops, costs the city millions of dollars. She does so because of her political affiliations and her beliefs, destroying the careers of six cops. She is humiliatingly defeated in every one of the trials, and she's currently under lawsuit, civil lawsuit for her actions. But it doesn't end there. Just in the last few days, it gets more bizarre. It would seem that like the leadership of that city is doing everything they can to destroy the morale of their cops. So they're incredibly understaffed. So now, just in the last week, a headline comes out that the new class that's being released onto the street from the police academy has failed. The majority of them have failed some of the critical courses in the class and in criminal law, and so they're passing them anyway. They took the instructor who failed them, they removed him and put somebody else in his place so that they would pass the test. So now they've basically lowered the standards. They're going to be releasing these guys out onto the streets to become cops. They've already shown that they're not ready. So this is a recipe for disaster, right? So there's that. That's in the headlines this week. And then this came out just a couple days ago. The mayor and the police commissioner, they have now decided that in the event that their police officers are sued civilly, well, they're not going to pay for it. Yeah, the officers are going to have to pay for their own defense. I mean, I've never heard of anything so incredibly moronic when it comes down to how to treat your employees. So, you know, listen, frivolous lawsuits are a dime a dozen when it comes to policing. You know, everybody's looking for a deep pocket. They sue for anything and everything. And now the city is saying, oh, by the way, officers, you're going to be liable for your own defense. And if you're found, if there's a finding against you, you're going to have to pay it out of your own pocket. I've never heard of this in any police department in any part of this country ever. So Baltimore PD is now, and when they get called on it by the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, they've got the I'm not going to say what I want to say. They've got the guts to say, oh, but this has been a policy forever. They've never enforced it. Oh, really? Yeah, okay. I'm sure that's the case. Well, you know, make it more difficult for police to do their jobs, if you want to make it more dangerous for the citizens of that beleaguered city, you couldn't create a recipe that's any better than what you have just done when you now have taken any protections away from these officers and now publicly stated that they're on their own when it comes to a lawsuit. So when I think that police leadership and city leadership can't do anything more stupid, then you get something like this in Baltimore. And I, honestly, I don't know how those guys are ever doing their jobs. You know, you're just going to see more depolicing, and you're going to see more and more crime as the you know, and they're already the number one murder rate in the country. Can't imagine why. It shows that the police leadership and the city leadership couldn't care less about the people that you know, that elected them. Well, that, my friends, is my view from the blue. Anybody that has worn ballistic body armor knows that, first of all, it's uncomfortable. Secondly, it's hot as hell, and depending on the climate, you know, these things can get a little bit rank. Well, you know, I know that as a cop, I was constantly struggling with this, especially in Vegas, where it's so damn hot that you sweat within this thing, and one of the difficult things is keeping it fresh. Well, there is now an amazing product that eliminates the odor from your vest in 4 seconds or less. Yeah, I know, it's fantastic. And it doesn't only work on vests, it works on anything. Diaper pails, so it's not just for cops, it's for household use as well. It's an odor eliminator and doesn't have any harmful chemicals. It was made by of a very famous deodorant company, whose name I will not mention. But this thing is amazing, and if they got a great website name, it's stinkyvest.com. Yeah, you heard me right, stinkyvest.com. Go check this out. It's good for, like I said, all odors, pet odors, but it's made specifically for the vest. But it's good for everything all around the house. So check it out at stinkyvest.com.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
I have a very special guest with me on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. He's the chief of police in Fresno, California, Chief Jerry Dyer. Jerry has been the chief of police since 2001, which I believe has got to be some record for chiefs of police. And he's been a police officer for 37 years. Chief, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Well, thank you, Randy. Appreciate you having me on the show today.
So, am I right? Is that a record since 2001 to be the chief of police?
Well, if for one law enforcement agency, it's on the longest standing that I'm aware of, in the major city chiefs anyway, right? So, yeah, it's been a long run, 16 years, be 17 years in August.
That's fantastic. You know, I think that the average lifespan for a chief of police in the United States, I think, is somewhere around 2.5 years. So you're way ahead of the game. You must be doing something right.
Yeah, well, politics sometimes shortens the lives of police chiefs.
Amen to that. You know, while we're talking about politics, what really caught my attention, although I do follow police leadership all over the country, of course, as a journalist, but when I saw a interview that you had
on the news, I was really taken aback and very happy to see that you didn't mince any words. You had something to say, and you said it. And I'd like to just bring that awareness to my listeners. You basically called out the California governor and the legislators for creating the environment that is now pervasive in California, which really does bring the safety of the citizens into question.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And when you look at what has happened in California over the last 7 or 8 years, with the weakening of the laws and the reduction in prison population in California since 2006 has been reduced by 31%. It went from a peak
31%
it went about 163,000 people in prison, I believe, in 2006. That number got reduced to under 112,000 in 2015. It's even lower today. So 50 to 55,000 fewer inmates in California prisons today. And we all know that those individuals did not get out of prison and be rehabilitated or reformed. The vast majority of those individuals are continuing a life of crime because they're career criminals in the first place. And that's what caused them to be in the California prison system.
That is a frightening number. And that's the state prisoners. You're not even talking about federal prisoners.
Yeah, that's just a... state convictions within the California prison system, and I do fault our California legislature and our governor for the weakening of those laws and the support that they have given to these pieces of legislation or propositions, and the fact that many of the voters in California were misled. One of the propositions was Proposition 47 that reclassified many of the drug offenses and property offenses. What used to be a felony, now a misdemeanor, possession of heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine. Some of the property offenses raised the value, so individuals that are stealing are now being arrested for misdemeanor. And the simple fact is many of these propositions were funded by the governor and supported by the governor and the legislature. And then we had another piece of legislation, Assembly Bill that passed 109, and that served to also transfer authority for individuals that would generally be sent to prison to local jurisdictions, meaning that they'd have to be incarcerated in those local jails if in fact they reoffended. The reality was those jails were already full because of federal consent decrees. They couldn't accept any more prisoners, so those inmates are back out on our streets committing auto thefts and burglaries and violent crimes. And when they created AB 109, they said it was only going to impact those individuals that were nonviolent, non-serious, non-sex offenders. Well, the reality is in our community, 80% of the people on AB 109 probation are gang members, and 80% have a history of violence. So that is misleading the voters of California. And that Proposition 47, the one I spoke of prior, was titled the Safe Neighborhoods and Schools Act.
Extremely misleading. That's outrageous. And they basically pulled the wool over the voters' eyes again.
Yeah. And so when I said at the news conference that we have a weak governor and a weak legislature and an uninformed voter population, that's exactly what I referred to. And that press conference was to lay out 100 guns that we had seized during that month in our city from gang members. Many of those individuals are those that should have been in prison, those individuals that are under AB 109 or Proposition 47, those that are out there committing crimes without the fear of consequences.
And isn't, if my memory serves, there was just a weakening of the sentencing guidelines also when it comes to weapons, when crimes are committed with guns, as far as the sentencing goes for the judges.
Yeah, judges have authority to be able to strike or to reduce certain strikes. We operate under the three strikes law in California. It originated right here in Fresno as a result of Mike Reynolds, the author, his daughter Kimber being killed in our city. And she was killed by a career criminal, and that was the beginning of three strikes right here in California. And that law has proven to be extremely effective over the years. Well, it didn't take too long before, again, that law was weakened through a proposition, Proposition 36, I believe it was, and it made that the third strike had to be a violent felony anyway. So you could have been in prison for a prior shooting, got out of prison, had another shooting, got out of prison, and then the third offense used to be just any type of a criminal act that you could be arrested for, felony. Then it had to become, again, a violent felony. So I just think we're giving too many opportunities, too many chances to these individuals to continue to go out and commit violent crimes. And the people that are suffering are the folks that live in our communities.
Exactly. And you know, it's one of the things that was taking place during, seemed to begin with the White House during the Obama years, was the emptying federal prisons and changing the federal guidelines. And then that was encouraged on a state level as well. So it wasn't just the state prisoners. Under the Obama administration, the Department of Justice was releasing people on a wholesale basis as well. So in essence, in the last, say, 8 or 9 years following Obama and what's going on in California, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of violent offenders have been spit back out, back into the communities to continue their criminal enterprises.
Yeah, there's no question. At the federal level, there was a sentencing reduction on the guidelines that they provided for those individuals that had been in prison, federal prison, for sales of drugs. And what was learned as a result of that was that maybe the individual was in prison for selling a certain quantity of drugs, but he or she would have also had a prior conviction for some sort of a violent crime. And we know people that are involved in selling quantities of drugs. There's always a potential for associated violence with that. They're carrying firearms. They're out there shooting individuals based on whatever feuds they may have. The significant majority of those individuals are involved in gangs. And so they're violent. And it's difficult to convince certain individuals in the elected arena that just because a person may be in prison for a certain offense, that doesn't mean that's all the crimes that he had committed. Oftentimes, as we know, you plea bargain. And so maybe you plea to a certain possession of drugs, but the reality is you did a number of other things as well. So we do. We have an abundance of criminals roaming around on our streets.
You know, and if you go by, and the way they sold this, I wrote about this extensively and spoke about it on this show. The way that they sold this bill of goods was that these were, quote, nonviolent drug offenders, and they just minimized the crimes that they committed. But as you said, I mean, if you go by that definition, then Al Capone, who went to prison on tax evasion, they should have just let him out too.
Yeah, he would have been considered nonviolent.
Exactly.
A gangster, a mobster gangster who was responsible for a lot of shootings would have been considered nonviolent as well. And that's a frustration, I think, on the part of law enforcement, just knowing that people are being misled by those individuals that we elect to service. That is a disservice.
And let's extrapolate this out a little bit. From speaking to active duty law enforcement, I'm of course retired a few years, But in speaking to the active duty guys, I get this sense of absolute frustration that the revolving door is revolving much faster, and that they, you know, this affects morale. It affects the proactive policing component, which of course is where crime is solved, and so it also creates an environment where it's difficult to retain your officers and hire more. Have you found that to be an issue as well?
Yeah, I saw a combination of things. We went through the recession, and so we lost about 20% of our officers. And then on top of that, we were seeing a weakening of the laws, so the job of a police officer, the ones remaining, was much harder. We also, at that time, saw what happened in Ferguson and the negative image of law enforcement, the false narrative that was being portrayed across the country. It made it very difficult to have officers out there feeling supported and having high morale. I think a vast majority of that has turned. I know at least in our department, there's a very high morale within the field. We've started hiring again, but we're still having to deal with the weakened laws in California. And fortunately, many of the officers that we've hired over the last 3 or 4 years weren't aware of the old system, so they've grown accustomed to the new system and just believe that's the way it's always been. But there was a time when we had strong laws, and that pendulum, I've never seen the pendulum of justice swing so far to the left so fast and stay so long as I have this time.
That's frightening, and I don't see, unfortunately, not only do I not see it getting better, I only see it getting worse.
Yeah, and we know over the years what causes the pendulum to readjust or to swing back to the right are tragedies.
Yes.
Tragedies that occur across our country when families of high-profile people or elected officials unfortunately become victimized. And then there is a sense of awakening in communities across America, and then the laws begin to change. And that's unfortunate that we have to wait for a tragedy before we change the laws versus changing the laws to avoid a tragedy.
And you would,
and that's what we live in today.
I agree entirely. And unfortunately, instead of elected leadership leading from the front, they seem to be not even responsive to the tragedies. I mean, look at the Kate Steinle case. Instead of I would have really thought that was going to move the pendulum to the right, as you said, but it doesn't seem to be working that way this time.
No, I think it's going to take a series of incidents and tragedies, and it's going to require us in law enforcement to be bold, to be courageous, to point out to our elected officials, our politicians, the impact that is occurring in our country. And unfortunately, too often, the only thing they look at is, well, are violent crime and property crime numbers up or down? That isn't the measure. Because we don't understand under reporting to the degree that we should. And what we don't understand is, well, maybe violent crime went down 2%, but maybe with some better laws, it could have went down 10%. And so we become satisfied by simply having a reduction in crime when that reduction could be far greater and we could prevent far more people from being victimized in our communities.
Well, and then also you're talking about the manipulation of the crime statistics by changing the laws and decriminalizing certain things or defelonizing certain things. And of course that then cooks the books, if you will, and makes it look like there's a reduction in crime.
Well, one of the measurements that I think is an unfair measurement that is being used in California is a reduction in recidivism. And of course there's going to be a reduction in recidivism, meaning those individuals that get sent back to prison because they have decriminalized it. What used to be a felony is now a misdemeanor. What used to be a misdemeanor now is an infraction. And you know, what used to be an infraction or a misdemeanor is no longer against the law. So, of course, there's going to be a reduction in recidivism. But what we ought to be measuring is, what's the rate of victimization?
Yes.
How many people are being, how many families are having to bury a loved one that didn't have to? How many families are having to suffer a tragedy of a child being molested or shot in a drive-by shooting when they didn't have to? And that's what we ought to be looking at.
You're absolutely right. It should be victim-centered and not based on statistical analysis, which can be manipulated by in many different ways. Let me ask you some questions though about how you're dealing with, you know, we've seen a tremendous drop in morale of law enforcement, but I agree with you in what you said, that there is that is beginning to change. How are you dealing as a police leader? How do you look at, you've got how many officers?
About 850.
All right, that's a big department. How do you as a police leader address the morale issues that face your cops?
Well, we recognize, number one, our officers have a very difficult job, and as the police chief, I know what they look for first and foremost is whether or not they have support from me, my level, and I do support our officers. I recognize they have a dangerous job, a difficult job, and so that's foremost. Being supportive of them from the top, and not spending your time second guessing them or what if the situation to death. Just recognize they have a difficult job, and hold those accountable who need to be held accountable. The other thing is, we know today that especially the younger generation appreciates more time with family. And we've created a platoon schedule in our patrol that allows for anyone that comes on the job to have every other weekend off, and that be a four-day weekend. That has proven to be a significant morale booster.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is making sure they have the right equipment and training so that they can go out and do their job safely. And I believe when you take care of all of those things, you're training people, you're giving them the right equipment, giving them good patrol vehicles, long rifles in every car, the tasers, good firearms, ballistic helmets, ballistic vest, and giving them the technology, the tools that they need to do their job. And again, a good shift and equitable pay. Once you do that with these officers and support them from the top and appreciate them often, you're going to have high morale. And I believe right now, at least according to my FVOA president, a few weeks ago said that he felt that the morale was at an all-time high. And as a chief, that's good to hear.
That's I don't think you can measure success any better, to tell you the truth. You know, you touched on something really important, and that's the training aspect of law enforcement. You know, there's been some serious weird trends that have taken place in the last, I'm going to say, 8 years or so. And one of them just reared its ugly head in New York City. Just a few days ago, they announced that they are spending $4.5 million to train the entire force for 8 hours of training in, quote, implicit bias training designed to help cops handle interactions with the public more fairly. Now, if you're going to devote $4.5 million in training money, don't you think it could go to a something that is less, shall we say, politically correct and more involved in keeping your cops safe?
Yeah, that's the balance. And I don't know what the laws are in New York in terms of training mandates. I do know in California, the training mandate is law enforcement agencies across California are mandated to train in implicit bias. And, you know, we too have provided that training to our officers as part of our overall training. Now, That training is implicit bias. It is decision making. It's ties into our tactical training. So it's one piece of a broader perspective of training. But again, California law enforcement is mandated to provide that training to their officers. And it depends on how that training is taught and who teaches the classroom setting. And for everyone in our department to know, we all have some type of a bias for whatever reason, whether experience or training or upbringing. You recognize that bias, whatever it is, and then you're better able to deal with it. And hopefully that's what they're doing in New York. I know that's what we did in Fresno. And again, throughout California, that's the type of training that is mandated.
Brought to you by the same people who are emptying the prisons.
Yeah, and we have another mandate that's coming out that is more worrisome, and that is whenever we've been tracking what's called demographic data on traffic stops for 15 years, and you know we do that, and now the requirement is to do it for all pedestrian contacts as well, and it becomes a very labor-intensive job in terms of filling out the paperwork once that occurs. And my biggest concern is that whenever you do that, whenever you require officers for just making a field contact, to require them to spend 20 minutes or 30 minutes filling out paperwork on that contact, that pretty soon officers are maybe not going to make those field contacts.
Exactly.
And we know that the way that we reduce crime in a community is that we make contact with individuals. That's how we come across guns and individuals that are in gangs and want it. You know, we don't have gang members flagging down police officers driving through a neighborhood and say, hey, I need to turn myself in, and by the way, I have a gun on me. It doesn't
right.
work that way.
Right.
We go out, we develop probable cause on individuals. We stop them legally. We're professional, respectful. But that's how we do our job, and that's how we keep neighborhood safe. And so this upcoming law, and it's going to be throughout California, and different size agencies have to implement at certain times, but it's going to be very cumbersome, very labor-intensive for us.
I had not heard about this.
Yeah, ultimately, I believe it's going to result in decreased proactive police work.
Well, you know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, perhaps that is that it's deep policing, it's creating deep policing purposefully, and I I can't help but think that they know exactly what they're doing by doing that.
Yeah, I believe that's either an intentional or unintentional consequence of what they're doing with that. And I guess the good news at the end of the day is that we have a long list of individuals that want to be police officers in our department. We're getting very high quality police officers with bachelor's degrees, master's degree, military experience, officers that are out there trying to do a good job, working hard, they're in shape. You know, we're able to make a difference. I violent crime down 15% in our city this year. Last year was down 7%. And so we're making progress in spite of all the challenges we face in our weak legal system. Our officers are still out there working hard and not giving up, not, you know, laying around in the fetal position. They're out there working hard, putting criminals in jail, and engaging the community in a positive way to make sure that we don't alienate them in the process. So good things happening in spite of the bad things in our state capital, Sacramento.
And I think that shows you the resilience of the American police officer. And I think that as we move forward, there will have to be changes that come from, you know, the snowflake concept of law enforcement. You know, it really comes down to proactive law enforcement, proactive policing. That's where the rubber meets the road. And although, you know, there have been all of these roadblocks thrown in front of it, it really is the resiliency of those officers who continue to go out there and do the job properly. And it sounds to me like you got a pretty good handle on that, Chief.
Well, I believe we do, and we got the right people in place in our department, right focus, right vision and mission, and the officers out there are doing an incredible job of balancing all of the demands that they have with addressing homelessness and mental illness and all of the other things that they're confronted with, the societal ills that have all fallen in the lap of law enforcement. In spite of that, our officers staying focused on the main thing, and that's keeping people safe.
If there was one thing that you could address the American public and say to them about your department and about its mission, what would that be?
So in terms of our mission, it's very simple, and it's to provide effective service to our citizens, to keep people safe, and to treat people with dignity and respect. And I must tell you that what I see in law enforcement today is that it is still a noble profession. It is still a profession that I believe across America, the vast majority of people support our efforts in every community. And we can't lose sight of that, that absent our police officers out there in the field, I can't even imagine what this country would look like. They're working hard day in and day out, putting their life on the line. And they are the ones sacrificing, spending nights and weekends at work while their families are at home, being called away on the holidays. And I think we need to remember that. They have, in my opinion, outside of our military, the most difficult job in America. And we need to demonstrate our appreciation for them, which is why I appreciate what you do with Support Blue. We have a Support Blue run coming up here at the end of the month, and we'll have about 3,500 to 4,000 people running in this Support Blue run. Our chaplaincy puts it on, and, you know, there's incredible support growing for law enforcement. We just need to keep it going.
I couldn't agree more, and I want to thank you for not only taking the time to visit with us here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I appreciate you not only taking the time, but giving us your message.
I appreciate it, Randy. Thanks for all you do to support law enforcement, and thanks for having me on the show today. Danger!
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to those men and women of the profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty. Unfortunately, this week I have four names to read. The first is Deputy Sheriff Micah Flick of the El Paso County Sheriff's Office in Colorado. Deputy Sheriff Micah Flick was shot and killed while conducting an auto theft investigation in the area of Galley Road and North Murray Boulevard in Colorado Springs at approximately 4 p.m. Several officers attempted to take a suspect into custody, but the man began to struggle and then opened fire, fatally wounding Deputy Flick and wounding two other deputies, a Colorado Springs officer and a bystander. The man was shot and killed by returned gunfire. Deputy Flick had served the El Paso County Sheriff's Office for 11 years. He was killed on the 11th anniversary of starting with the department. He survived by his wife and 7-year-old twins. Deputy Sheriff Micah Flick, El Paso County Sheriff's Office, Colorado. End of watch, February 5th, 2018. The second officer to lose his life this week in the line of duty is Reserve Officer Gerate Dwayne Condit of the Asher Police Department in Oklahoma. Reserve Officer Gerate Condit was killed in a vehicle crash on U.S. Highway 177, south of State Highway 59 at approximately 5:30 p.m. He was en route to mandatory training in Shawnee when his patrol car left the roadway and crashed into a concrete culvert as he attempted to pass another vehicle. The patrol car became engulfed in flames upon impact. Officer Condit is survived by his young child and parents. Reserve Officer Gerate Dwayne Condit, Asher Police Department, Oklahoma. End of watch, Tuesday,
February 6, 2018. The third law enforcement officer to die this week in the line of duty is Deputy Sheriff Stephen Belanger of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Deputy Sheriff Steve Belanger succumbed to a gunshot wound sustained on December 10, 1994, when he was ambushed while conducting a traffic stop on LaGuardia in Roland Heights. He had recognized the driver of the vehicle as being wanted for a previous assault. As he searched the two occupants, one of the man's friends rode up to Deputy Belanger on a skateboard and shot him in the back of the head. The man fled the scene and committed suicide an hour later. Doctors were unable to remove the bullet from Deputy Belanger's brain. He remained under constant medical care, confined to a wheelchair until passing away on February 6, 2018. Deputy Belanger had served with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department for 7 years. He is survived by his wife and daughter. Deputy Sheriff Stephen Belanger, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, End of Watch, February 6, 2018. The fourth officer to die in the line of duty this week is Police Officer David Sherrard of the Richardson Police Department in Texas. Police Officer David Sherrard was shot and killed while responding to a disturbance at an apartment complex on East Renner Road. As officers arrived on scene, they located a man suffering from a gunshot wound outside of the apartment. The officers were able to identify an apartment where the suspect was located. As they made entry into the apartment, the man opened fire, striking Officer Sherrard in the neck. He was transported to Medical City, Plano, where he succumbed to his wound. The subject barricaded himself inside of the apartment for several hours before surrendering. The man who shot Officer Sherrard was charged with capital murder of a police officer. Officer Sherrard had served with the Richardson Police Department for 13 years. He is survived by his wife and two daughters. Police Officer David Sherrard, Richardson Police Department, Texas. End of watch, Wednesday, February 7th, 2008. One thing I know from being a police officer for as many years as I've been is that off-duty police officers spend a lot of their time working extra jobs. You know, the police salaries around the country, let's face it, they're not that great. And off-duty officers have to, in many cases, work extra jobs, security jobs, traffic jobs. So there is a company, believe it or not, the owner of this company was actually a guest on my show, Bonnie Lucas, and it's a company called Law Enforcement Specialists Incorporated, and they put off-duty officers to work in more than 40 states throughout this country. It's a phenomenal idea, and these people really know what they're doing. So if you're an active duty police officer and you're looking for extra jobs, now they do this in connection with your own police agency. So you're not violating any department rules, regulations. You're actually working in concert. They just find extra jobs for you, and then they work with your agency to get you those extra jobs. So it's a phenomenal idea. They've been doing this for years. And like I said, they're in most states in the union. I didn't even know they existed. But when I spoke to Bonnie, who owns this company, I was very, very impressed. So check them out at www.offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's www.offdutypoliceofficers.com. And you'll be able to find out whether you're in there in a state that they work in. They tout themselves as an exclusive nationwide security solution utilizing active duty law enforcement officers. Having trained, armed, and uniformed police officers present is an extremely effective way of deterring threats. And we all know that's true. So check them out. www.offdutypoliceofficers.com. It's a great way to make extra money, and it's completely within your department guidelines. And check them out. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. I enjoy having guests on. I hope that you enjoy it as well. You can follow me on Facebook if you go to Randy Sutton, public figure, and just like and follow. I do a lot of my posting every single day on that venue. And also, if you are a Twitterer, at LT Randy Sutton. That's at LT Randy Sutton. That's on Twitter. And I'm going to do a few more social medias as well. I'm also on LinkedIn. So if you want to hook up on LinkedIn, check me out there. So thanks again for listening in on this week's episode. And I'll see you again next week.